Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff will return next week. In today's show, we will cover the importance of civil disobedience for social change. We interview Tim DeChristopher, American climate activist and co-founder of the environmental groups Peaceful Uprising and Climate Disobedience Center. Later in the program, we'll talk with abortion rights activist Sansara Taylor regarding the Stop Patriarchy movement. We hope you will stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. In today's show, we're covering the importance of civil disobedience for social change. We're interviewing Tim DeChristopher, American climate activist and co-founder of the environmental groups Peaceful Uprising and Climate Disobedience Center. Tim is an American climate activist and co-founder of the environmental groups Peaceful Uprising and Climate Disobedience Center. In December of 2008, he protested the Bureau of Land Management oil and gas lease auction of 116 parcels of public land in Utah's Red Rock County by successfully bidding on 14 parcels of land, 22,000 acres for $1.8 million, with no intentions to pay for them. DeChristopher was removed from the auction by federal agents, taken into custody, and eventually served 21 months in prison. During his trial, DeChristopher's defense team sought to rely on what is called a necessity defense, which required proof that DeChristopher was forced to choose between two evils and that his actions resulted in the lesser of two to avoid imminent harm where no legal alternative was available. So, Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You've been engaging now in civil disobedience and encouraging people to do that in a very active way, and you focus on climate. What is your motivation for that?
I think climate change is one of many clear issues where the urgency of the situation is so clear and the crisis is so serious, and yet the government's response to it is so clearly inadequate, and they're failing to address the challenge of actually defending our civilization from the threat of climate change. And so I feel like that's an area where it creates a clear necessity for action by regular citizens to directly stand in the way of the fossil fuel industry and try to defend a livable future.
Tell us more about the history of how you ended up in jail for 2 years. The way I read it, you didn't exactly plan to do that or end up in jail, but it just sort of happened. You felt compelled.
You know, at that time in 2008, I had been growing more and more concerned about climate change for the previous few years, and was also studying social movement history and seeing that the climate movement, especially at that time, looked nothing like any successful social movement in our history, because it was trying to appease our current power structure. And it was trying to create kind of a non-threatening movement that was advocating for a cleaner, greener version of the world that we have now, where we kind of switch out our power sources and keep every other injustice about our society the same. You know, as opposed to most of our social movements in our history that have challenged our current power structure and have articulated a big vision of a truly healthy and just world. So I saw the need for a more confrontational kind of movement that was engaging in things like civil disobedience to kind of rattle the current power structure. And so I was looking for opportunities for that. And this auction came around and it seemed like as good of an opportunity as any. And so I showed up with the intent to do whatever I could to stand in the way of this auction. I saw it as kind of the perfect intersection of a lot of the land use issues that are very salient in Utah, and also just the drill now, think later kind of mentality that's driving the climate crisis. So I showed up thinking I might give a speech or get dragged out by security and that sort of thing. And when I showed up, they said, "Would you like to be a bidder?" And I said, "Well, yes, I would." And then just saw the opportunity right there to actually have a major impact.
So they were leasing land. This was public land, BLM land, Bureau of Land Management, for drilling, for gas, oil, whatever.
Yeah, right.
And you bid on 22,000 acres, and then, of course, you had no intention of paying. So did that block the sale of that land or that lease for a while?
Yeah, so that was a somewhat unusual auction because it was the very last one under the Bush administration. So they were trying to get as much into the hands of the oil and gas industry as possible. And it was the first one under the new resource management plans that they'd spent all 8 years of the Bush administration rewriting. So it was kind of the one opportunity where they had a complete open-door policy to auction off these lands right outside of Canyonlands and Arches National Parks. So once I disrupted it, there was a lot of other opposition to this auction as well. There were groups filing lawsuits and things like that. So it created enough attention then that the new Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, who came in under the Obama administration, had to then admit that they weren't following their own laws in holding that auction in the first place. And so they rescinded not only the parcels that I won, but most of the other parcels in the auction as well. And that kind of entered like a sort of limbo period for that block of land, and it ushered in a new reconsideration of how that auction process is done. So now the most recent development just a few months ago was a new draft master leasing plan for the whole Moab area of the Bureau of Land Management that actually permanently puts most of those parcels that I bid on permanently off limits to drilling.
You ended up spending 21 months in federal prison, correct?
Right.
Yep. And was it worth it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was kind of more worth it than I ever expected. You know, when I went into it, I expected I would probably go to prison. And at that time, I was fairly focused on the direct impacts of that drilling and keeping that oil in the ground. But I found that it also had, you know, and it accomplished that, but it also had much more indirect impacts of empowering others to take action and setting an example and kind of galvanizing a movement there in Utah, and also being a part of a lot of factors that pushed the mainstream climate movement to be much more confrontational and to broadly embrace tactics like civil disobedience.
You've created a civil disobedience center. You've been educating people on these tactics. Talk a little bit about the importance of civil disobedience for social change.
I think the primary thing that civil disobedience does is it uses the power of one's own vulnerability, both before the justice system and often vulnerability in a physical kind of way. It uses that power of vulnerability to arouse the conscience of a community. And I think approaching things with one's own vulnerability is rather shocking in our society that seems to only understand a power that stems from domination and a power of control. And tapping into a power of vulnerability kind of rattles people out of their everyday apathy and lethargy of their consumer lives and forces them to deal with that human connection that they are exposed to through the power of vulnerability. So the Climate Disobedience Center folks and I were up in Seattle working on the Delta 5 trial of five activists that blockaded an oil train about a year and a half ago. And they were the first ones in the climate movement who have been able to actually use the necessity defense and present those arguments in court. And we saw the tremendous impact that that trial and the vulnerability of those activists who were the defendants, we saw the power that that had on their own community and on the court system itself. You know, by the end of that trial, the jurors were hugging the defendants and signing up to go to their next lobby day and thanking them for the education that they had gotten during that trial that week.
So the Delta 5 activists were a group that blockaded a bomb train,
right,
a train loaded with crude oil that have been derailing and causing some serious problems around the country and in Canada. And they ended up being charged and going to court, but they were allowed to mount or at least talk about the danger of climate change. But the judge wouldn't let the jury use that to decide. Explain
right.
How that happened.
Well, it ended up being a sort of schizophrenic case from the part of the judge, where first he denied the necessity defense, then he overruled himself 2 days later on a motion to reconsider and allowed the arguments for necessity defense. So for the first 4 days of the trial, the defendants were able to not only testify on their own behalf, but put expert witnesses on the stand to talk about the threat of climate change, the immediate threat of these bomb trains rolling through communities, and also talk about the way that the fossil fuel industry has corrupted our political process. Talk about money and politics and the Exxon New revelations and the massive climate denial machine. And talk about the history of civil disobedience and all that kind of stuff. And it was phenomenal for 4 days. And they were able to present really the most comprehensive case for climate action that I've seen anywhere, and certainly the most comprehensive that's ever been presented in an American courtroom. So that was really impressive. And then when it came to the part of the trial about jury instructions, the judge ruled that the defense hadn't sufficiently met the fourth standard of necessity defense, which is that there are no reasonable legal alternatives. And so the judge then denied the necessity defense for closing arguments and then instructed the jury that all of that expert testimony that they had just heard was now inadmissible, and they weren't allowed to consider any of that when making their final decision.
Explain more completely the necessity defense and the four elements that are required to really make that kind of a case.
The four elements of necessity defense are, I mean, basically the necessity defense argument is that one is acting out of necessity to prevent a greater harm than the law that they're violating. So the first element has to be a reasonable expectation of imminent harm. And the second element is that that harm that they're trying to avoid is greater than the harm of whatever crime that they're committing in doing so. And the third element is that the people in question didn't start the harm that they're trying to now avoid. And the fourth element is that there are no reasonable legal alternatives. So the classic example of necessity defense is if a house is on fire and there's a child upstairs and you kick the door in, which could be considered breaking and entering, you kick the door in to go save that child's life. So if you're charged then with breaking and entering, you can use a necessity defense to argue that you are acting out of necessity to prevent the greater harm of this child dying. And in order to use that defense, you have to show that there's an imminent harm with that house being on fire and a kid being inside. You have to show that the harm of that kid dying is greater than, you know, you breaking the door jamb of that door. And you have to show that you didn't start the fire. And you have to show that there's no reasonable legal alternatives to breaking and entering there. And that fourth hurdle of no reasonable alternatives is often the one that prevents civil disobedience cases from being able to use the necessity defense, because it's often argued that there are always reasonable alternatives within the legal system that you can, you know, write a letter to your congressperson, you can sign another petition, all these things. And so what it comes down to is the question of whether or not there is something unique that civil disobedience does in terms of social change that acting within the legal boundaries cannot do.
And that uniqueness, that is the potential to be creative with that or strategic with that, is always present, correct?
Yeah. You know, and so one of the things that this case came down to is kind of what the intent of the activists who were doing this civil disobedience was. And the prosecution was claiming that their intent was just to get media coverage, to get attention for their cause, for the threat of oil trains. And the judge seemed to kind of buy into the idea that that's what the intent was, to raise awareness, basically, to put it more positively, to raise awareness. And there wasn't a clear enough distinction that they were trying to do something different, that they were trying to raise awareness in a different kind of way than our normal public education campaigns. So there wasn't that emphasis on how civil disobedience can uniquely accomplish that role of arousing the conscience of a community in a way that all the kind of safe actions within the legal system that lack that element of vulnerability for the people in question, that none of those can accomplish in quite the same way, which is part of why civil disobedience has been such a critical part of our social movement history. The other specific issue in this case, which I believe might come up on appeals, since the activists were convicted on one of the charges, they were convicted of trespass, there is the opportunity to appeal. And I think what that will come down to is the question of whether reasonable legal alternatives includes the question of sufficiency, whether those legal alternatives are sufficient to avoid the harm. And that was part of the debate that was going on there in front of the judge, where the defense was trying to say, yes, there are legal alternatives. You can write a letter. You can do all those things. But all the activists in question have done all those things, and none of them are actually sufficient to avoid the harm of climate change. And the judge kind of dismissed that question of whether or not those are sufficient. But I think when you look at the basic argument around necessity outside of civil disobedience cases, obviously sufficiency has to come into question. You know, if that house is burning, of course there are legal alternatives that you could do. you could call the rural fire department that might be 15 miles away and hope that they get there before that child dies. You could throw a bucket of water from the stream on it. You know, you could spit on it. You could try to blow it out like a birthday cake. The question is, are any of those things actually going to save the life of that child, right? And for them to be reasonable alternatives, they have to be sufficient to avoid that harm. And so I think there's an opportunity with this case in the appeals court to clarify that ruling and potentially expand the use of the necessity defense for civil disobedience cases.
It would seem that the power structure, oil companies, any corporation that's worried about civil disobedience would push very hard to try to not allow a necessity defense in any case, whether you have infant formula that you're feeding children in Guatemala or privatizing the water, or certainly this case of Flint with the terrible water situation there. The necessity defense opens up and shows a justification for real obstruction in many ways. And in fact, with the Delta 5, the train was stopped. And trains are dangerous. They don't fall off the tracks all the time, but there's a predictable regularity that could have major consequences. And your center is encouraging these kinds of actions, correct?
Yeah. And, you know, part of that is the impact, and that's why corporations are afraid of these kinds of actions, because they see that there are more and more reasons for people to be resisting the corporate control of our government. You know, the lead activist in the Delta 5 case, the woman who was at the top of the tripod, Abby Brockway, about 3 or 4 months before they blockaded that train, there was a train that derailed in Seattle less than a mile from her daughter's school. And the oil cars derailed but didn't explode, thankfully. But it was enough of a close call and a wake-up call for her that she was propelled into action. And one of the other defendants runs a coffee shop and lives above the coffee shop in downtown Everett, Washington, where the oil trains run about half a mile from his shop, which means that the technical term for where his shop is called the fireball zone. So, you know, it's a very salient issue for him. I mean, he has lots of reasons to continue standing up against those oil trains.
We are listening to the Project Censored show. Tim DeChristopher is an American climate activist and co-founder of the environmental groups Peaceful Uprising and Climate Disobedience Center. We're now going to take a short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Today we're covering the importance of civil disobedience for social change, and we're interviewing Tim DeChristopher, American climate activist and co-founder of the environmental groups Peaceful Uprising and Climate Disobedience Center. Tim, you went to the Harvard Divinity School, so talk about why you did that and the importance of spirituality in all of this.
I made that decision a little before I went to prison that I needed to go to divinity school. And that had grown out of my time in between when I disrupted the auction and when I got incarcerated, where I was pretty much a full-time climate activist in those years. And I was seeing that the challenge of the climate movement was shifting and that it was going beyond just the job of reducing emissions to increasingly moving towards the job of figuring out how we can maintain our humanity as we navigate this period of chaotic change that is now largely inevitable. And so looking around the climate movement, I realized that we didn't have any of the tools and skills to even begin that conversation of how we hold on to our humanity in desperate times, how we hold on to our values in a seemingly hopeless situation. But it seemed to me that religious traditions did have a set of tools and skills for that, because that's what people have often turned to religious communities for. And so I was certainly thinking in that direction. And then sort of the galvanizing moment for me was in my trial, in the jury selection process. The judge and the prosecutor found out that about three quarters of the jury pool had received a pamphlet before they walked in to the courthouse on the first day from the Fully Informed Jurors Association. And it was a pamphlet that didn't say anything about my case, but it talked about jury rights and why we have juries, how juries are meant to be the conscience of the community to protect their fellow citizens from the government. And when they found that out, the prosecution just lost their minds. And we had to have a meeting in the judge's chamber where the prosecution was asking for a mistrial to get rid of the entire jury pool. And he was almost spitting when he was reading from this pamphlet saying, "This notion of voting your conscience is out in space." And rather than declare a mistrial, the judge called each of the potential jurors one at a time into his chambers, with me and my legal team on one side and the prosecution on the other, and the judge at the head of the table kind of speaking down to this potential juror in his patriarchal kind of way. And he said, "You need to understand that it's not your job to decide what's right or wrong. Your job is to listen to what the law says, and you have to enforce it even if you think it's morally wrong. Can you do that? Can you do what I ask you to do even if you think it's morally wrong?" And I was sitting in the seat closest to the juror, and I watched one person after another say, "Yes, Your Honor, I'll do whatever you ask me to do, even if I think it's morally wrong." And I could tell that they meant it. You know, they were out of their element. They had all of this authority kind of bearing down on them, and they just accepted this idea that that it wasn't their job to decide what's right or wrong, and they were just following orders from this authority. And at that moment, I understood better than I ever had before how some of the great atrocities in history could happen, how something like a Holocaust or a genocide could happen when an entire citizenry is willing to let go of their own moral authority and abandon their own conscience. And yet at the same time, I saw this prosecutor who was the United States attorney. He had the full power of the United States government behind him, and he was freaking out at the notion of citizens using their conscience when they're exercising their civic duties. He was absolutely terrified. And so I saw this huge power hinging on our faith in our own moral authority and our faith in our conscience, where if we abandoned our conscience, that any atrocity could be possible. But when we had faith in the moral, in our own moral authority and the shared moral authority of our community, that there is no power structure in the world that can't be impacted by that. And I realized that was really a spiritual struggle over whether or not we hold on to that faith in our conscience and in our moral authority. And that's a spiritual struggle that is actively being waged in our society, that is encouraging people to be obedient to these power structures and to disregard their own conscience. And that if we truly wanted to resist that, we had to be able to engage in that struggle in a spiritual way and be able to fight back for that faith in our shared moral authority.
That goes back to the Nuremberg trials, the Nuremberg principles, correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Where Nazis were convicted for not standing on moral authority against the Holocaust and other atrocities during the war. Yet that hasn't permeated national law today.
Right, and that was certainly an issue in the Delta V trial. You know, even though this judge was night and day different than the judge that I had many years ago and was far more open to the case for climate change, still he made the jurors under oath say that they would enforce the law even if they think it was morally wrong. And when it came down to his decision about the necessity defense, he said, as he was making that ruling on jury instructions, he said, "These defendants are exemplary citizens. I think what they're doing is excellent and ethical, and we need more of that. Our society needs more of that to defend against these threats. But these legal technicalities hold me to this decision. And because of this legal structure that I'm a part of, I need to stand in the way of this action that I think is moral and that I think we need more of to protect our society." Which was ironic after several days of testimony from expert witnesses who explained exactly how our political and legal structures are not adequate to address the climate crisis, that they're not working. And he kind of demonstrated that then with his own court process that is not adequate to address this crisis that he seemed to take seriously. But he was not willing to question that legal structure that he was a part of.
Chris Hedges has talked about the moral authority of people needing to resist global empire and war.
Right.
And he has a divinity background as well. I certainly hear what you're saying. This is the old Thomas Aquinas argument of individuals standing on their moral beliefs and challenging the Catholic Church at that time, the kind of imperial control of the Pope, and his response kind of keep himself out of being executed was to talk about right reason. That's how they ended up with the infallibility of the Pope. In a sense, the American government is claiming an infallibility of control over climate change, over citizens' lives, and you're saying, no, we have this moral authority that we want to engage in, and it's really an important thing to do.
Yeah, you know, and I think one of the things that is powerful about civil disobedience is that it does inherently question the sole moral authority of government. And it asserts a right for citizens to be exercising their own moral authority as well. And I think that's part of why the government is often so repressive of civil disobedience and of nonviolent direct action, because it is that implicit threat to their own moral authority. And a lot of people are pointing out how, you know, the government really isn't doing anything to hold the Bundys accountable, and the folks that are out there at the Malheur Refuge in Oregon. The government doesn't seem to be responding at all. And I think the reasons for that are probably many. But one of the big ones, I think, is that I don't think that those folks actually present a threat to the authority of government. A violent resistance against a government that is the greatest force of violence in the history of the world is not an actual threat. And in fact, it reinforces their moral authority to be such a violent force. But nonviolent resistance and civil disobedience presents a new kind of power. It is an implicit threat to that moral authority of a violent government.
It's certainly a powerful force that has been with us in terms of human history. And one of the books I had read early on in graduate school was Gene Sharp and Tactics of Nonviolent Social Change and 400 different possibilities of things that he'd listed, including, of course, how the people in Denmark resisted the Nazi Holocaust and protected Jews there. The burden of that challenge, of course, is individual. And individuals together can find ways to do very important things and challenge and see the moral authority or the lack of moral authority inside of government. And one of the key fights today, Black Lives Matters in the country, challenging police killings, over 1,200 last year, most of which were completely unjustified and unarmed individuals, many people of color. There was the blockade of the Bay Bridge by 25 activists stopping traffic. What do you think about that tactic?
My partner actually was one of the activists out there on the bridge, and so I kind of heard about it as it was developing. And I heard a very positive report about the opportunity to engage with people out on that bridge and have actual discussions. And certainly there was anger about people being inconvenienced and delayed, but it did kind of force them out of their normal routine to consider how the world is operating right now and who is suffering in order for the status quo to be maintained for the rest of us. And I think that's exactly the important work that civil disobedience does, is it arouses conscience through inconveniencing people, through disrupting the status quo of people's lives. There are plenty of other things for people to concern themselves with in their everyday life and focus on their jobs and their bills and their TV shows and whatever else, that it takes confrontation to rattle people out of that. You know, the great line from Frederick Douglass that power yields nothing without a demand has been used by activists in a lot of social movements as sort of a battle cry to challenge those at the top of our power structure, to challenge those authorities and remind ourselves that they're not going to give anything up without some disruption. But I think that idea is actually more expansive than just the authorities at the top of our power structure. I think that also applies to the sort of latent power that resides in our population, that might not be used in the sort of lethargic society that we have that is not civically engaged. But there is sort of a sleeping power there among the people. And that power is not going to yield anything to those who are marginalized in our society. That power is not going to yield anything without a demand, without being rattled and confronted. So I think the same kind of disruption and pressure that it takes to force change from authorities at the top of our government is equally true to force change from those who kind of sit back in our own privilege and have a different kind of power at maintaining the status quo in our society.
The degree to which climate change threatens human life and civilization and our existence is extreme. We interviewed David Ray Griffin in his new book, Unprecedented, where he had updated all the current dangers of climate change and that, and the acceleration of warming and rise of the seas and that. So we're talking major consequences here. So you're saying that this would justify, or it's more important and more powerful, to engage in direct civil disobedience. What are some other tactics then, besides stopping trains, and that civil disobedience can be most effective around?
Well, we've seen a huge rise in civil disobedience over the past few years in the climate movement. Probably the biggest recent thing that got a lot of attention was the Shell No blockades that were happening up in Portland and Seattle when Shell had their drilling rigs and their icebreakers that were set to go drill in the Arctic. And there was the kayak blockade that was happening out there. And there were the folks who rappelled down from the bridge and ended up blocking the icebreaker ship from there for a while. And, you know, that tactic was actually kind of inspired by something that happened the year before in Australia, where a huge group of Pacific Islanders and indigenous folks got out there in their traditional canoes and had a flotilla of their traditional canoes and kayaks that they used to block the port of Newcastle, and which is the largest coal port in the world. So they blocked the coal ships coming out of the port of Newcastle and had a powerful action there. We're seeing resistance really across the country where there's new fossil fuel infrastructure with pipelines that are going in and people standing in the way of those pipelines. We're seeing it with all the new coal-fired power plants that are going in. There's resistance to every one of those, with the export facilities that are happening across the West Coast and on the East Coast as well. So there's people standing in the way of that. And also I think people trying to approach it in more creative ways as well. Folks like the Yes Men that have an extremely creative approach to kind of disrupting business as usual have been getting a lot of attention as well.
Exxon now has been exposed as having been aware of the climate dangers 30, 40 years ago, covering it up, funding climate denial groups, and is now under investigation by the state of California. Is there something even more that needs to be done in that regard?
Yes, I think so. You know, one of the specific charges that I was incarcerated for, I got sentenced to 2 years for the charge of making false statements to federal officials. Because when I signed into the auction, I signed my name on a form that said any bids that I make will be bona fide bids. That signing my name on that form gave me 2 years in prison for false statements to federal officials. So ExxonMobil, as we now know, waged a campaign for decades to make false statements to federal officials in government hearings, in congressional hearings, in their statements to regulatory agencies. They hired people for the sole purpose of lying to federal officials. They coordinated a criminal enterprise for decades to lie to federal officials on something that has massive consequences for everyone on our planet. You know, there are countless lives at risk because of their criminal behavior of lying to the federal government on climate change. So, you know, I think that does take a serious criminal investigation for response there. And there have been some investigations by the state of New York and the state of now California that have opened up what seem to be RICO kind of lawsuits targeting Exxon. But it doesn't look like any of those are actually looking at criminal investigations that are going to be sending people to prison. And yet they're continuing to engage in this behavior. You know, they're continuing to fund these organizations. They're continuing to send their lobbyists to Washington. And I think that people need to be standing in the way of that as well, that, you know, we can look at the lobbying going on by Exxon as a crime in progress. And so in terms of direct action and civil disobedience, I think there's an opportunity for folks to directly stand in the way of that continued crime in progress.
Would that be standing in the way in an Exxon station and occupying them across the country?
You know, the tactic of standing at Exxon stations was used by Bill McKibben to get some attention to this. One of our founders of the Climate Disobedience Center, Ken Ward, has also done that at a couple of Exxon stations. I think it's been effective at bringing some attention to what's been going on with the Exxon revelations. But I think that there's more escalation that is necessary to directly confront.
You talk about the difference between just getting attention and public relations and getting in the news versus really engaging in an act that is deemed criminal, yet morally correct. And that's a big distinction. Now, many people can't fathom the idea of going to prison for 2 years. They have family obligations or whatever, but you certainly did that. Did you know that that might be the penalty when you were starting?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I expected, that I would be in prison for 2 to 3 years.
Wow. Well, that's certainly a commitment.
Yeah. I think people also have a mythical view of prison at this point that comes from all the prison shows and cop shows and lawyer shows, and perhaps comes from a historical accuracy of what prison used to be. But, you know, I think in the age of mass incarceration, our prisons are filled with normal people. You know, our prisons are filled with people who happen to be dealing drugs or using drugs and people who didn't pay their taxes and that sort of thing. So it's far from a horrible place. Prison was an inconvenience. It was frustrating because you're living inside a government bureaucracy 24 hours a day. So it's certainly frustrating. But I think people make plenty of frustrating sacrifices. You know, I always resist the interpretation where folks say that I lost 2 years of my life in prison or that I gave up 2 years of my life. I didn't give up 2 years of my life. I spent 2 years of my life in a radically different situation than how I've lived most of the rest of my life. But, you know, there are plenty of young people who care very strongly about an issue and go and spend 2 years or more working in Washington, D.C., banging their head against the wall in the halls of power, dealing with at least as miserable of a bureaucracy as any prison in the country.
Well, what's coming up for the Climate Disobedience Center? What are your plans? What is your direction?
Well, we're going to continue working with folks to try to use the necessity defense and supporting folks who are going to trial. There's continued wave after wave of civil disobedience in the climate movement and more folks who do need that kind of support. We learned a lot from the Delta 5 trial, and we've got a lot to review from that. And we think that trial gave us more specifics of exactly how we can use that defense better and how we can do better in the next trial. So we're going to be trying to learn from that and push forward with new cases and also work with folks who are training or thinking about doing civil disobedience and are looking for some advice and training on that and try to help folks set up good civil disobedience actions, pull off those actions in a way where the action doesn't just end at the moment where the handcuffs come out, but it continues to resonate through the public narrative, through their trial, through that whole process.
Tim, during your time in prison, what did you learn and did you find other activists there to engage with?
I didn't meet too many folks that had experience in activism, but I certainly met a lot of people that were incredibly interested in what I was doing. And I sort of got an automatic level of respect for being a political prisoner. And a lot of folks were interested in sort of how people who are outside of our traditional power structures can leverage power in their own way by organizing together. And what my experience there taught me was that it really deepened a lot of my understanding of social justice issues and further radicalized me. You know, there were a lot of things that I understood on an intellectual level before I went in. Like, I had read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander and stuff like that. You know, so I kind of knew the facts about a lot of issues. But spending those 2 years with some of the most oppressed people in our society kind of humanized the things that I knew on an intellectual level and really helped me internalize a lot of those injustices. So I think it made me more of a revolutionary being in there and directly seeing how our government is treating people. And I think just deepened my commitment to work for revolutionary change.
And by revolutionary, that's completely nonviolent.
Yes. You know, I think that we are at a point in our society where nonviolent resistance is more effective than violent resistance.
And in fact, violence can actually be destructive.
Yeah.
To the movement.
Right. So, you know, I think we should be taking the strongest action that we can to work for justice. And I think what that means is taking principled, nonviolent resistance against the status quo.
It's marching to the sea and making salt.
Good. Yep.
Where can people get more information about your activities?
All that information is at timdechristopher.org, and all the information about my upcoming events, and I'm trying to share more writings and things on that website, sharing my thoughts. At this point, I'm an independent community-supported activist. I don't work for the Climate Disobedience Center, and I'm trying to be able to maintain an independent voice in the climate movement so that I can push the boundaries of our actions and our discussion.
Tim, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we'll be talking with Sansara Taylor, abortion right activist, but we'll take a short musical break in the meantime.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is told. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Today we're having the theme, The Importance of Civil Disobedience for Social Change. Next, we'll talk with abortion rights activist Sansara Taylor regarding the Stop Patriarchy movement. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper. She's a dynamic speaker, an uncompromising atheist. Her challenge to the rise of Christian fascism has taken her to the gates of abortion clinics around the country and inside the stadiums where the battle cry to train anti-abortionist Christian youth shock troops has led to numerous impressive verbal battles with Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, and numerous others. Sansara, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hello, Peter. It's great to be with you.
Well, thanks very much. We've interviewed you probably a year or so ago in terms of what you were doing then, protecting abortion clinics and rights all over the country. Give us an update on what you're doing now and some of the battles that are happening in the United States today.
As a revolutionary and a communist, I'm dealing with the state of the whole world, but I know we want to talk about the war on women and why the fight over abortion is so central. And I would say for your listeners and for everybody that right now there's an emergency. It's a largely invisible emergency. It's a largely unseen emergency, but there's an emergency facing women's right to abortion. And clinics are being closed. Abortion clinics are being closed across the country. Women are resorting once again in huge numbers to self-inducing abortions. And not only are women being slammed backwards to the days of the coat hanger, we have an additional crime where women who are desperate enough to try to self-induce an abortion, like a young woman in Tennessee recently who used a coat hanger and went to the hospital fearing for her life because she was bleeding profusely. Instead of getting the help she needed to complete the abortion, the hospital removed the fetus from her body and forced her to become a mother against her will, and then turned her over to the state. So she's sitting in jail as we speak, and she's being charged with first-degree attempted murder. This is dragging women backwards and criminalizing them on top of that. And so taking away women's right to abortion, taking away the right to birth control, taking away from women the right to decide for themselves when and whether to have a child is a form of enslaving women to the dictates of a male supremacist patriarchal system that we live under. And that is actually what the anti-abortion movement is fighting for, is the enslavement of women. And they're getting very, very far in succeeding at that.
What activities have you been engaged in? Would you describe them as civil disobedience in many cases?
In some cases, definitely so. I come at this seeing that the crimes being perpetrated against women are rooted in a system, and patriarchy is woven into the system of capitalism, imperialism that we live under. And so the idea that you could rely on the channels, the official channels and politics of that system, which is based on and rooted in exploitation and oppression, you know, it's an illusion. So ultimately, we need a revolution to get rid of that system. And then even today, in the fight to build up the strength to make that kind of a revolution, people need to step out of bounds. That's the way advances have been won for the oppressed. It's the only way advances have been won for the oppressed in the history of this country. So one of the things around the abortion rights movement in particular, last year, every year on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, there are major anti-abortion mobilizations. Tens of thousands of religious fanatics, people who oppose birth control, abortion, who literally preach that women should submit to their husbands as the husband submits to the Lord, which is what the Bible says. People are marching behind this on both coasts, demanding an end to Roe versus Wade. And so last year, StopPatriarchy.org and myself and other RevComs with the Movement for Revolution, we went down to D.C. and counter-protested. And in that instance, we actually went into the street in front of the Supreme Court, where the anti-abortion march parades in front of the Supreme Court every year. And we went in the middle of the street and shut down their march and did nonviolent direct action, refused to leave the street. And 8 of our members got arrested down there. But it was a chance to actually say, no, we will not tolerate women haters and religious fascists marching unopposed and furthering this war on women. People need to put themselves on the line to stand up against this and to expose what it's about and to show the rest of the population, look, this is an emergency worth acting in such an extreme way over, and you should join this fight.
And in the case of the mass shootings at the Planned Parenthood in Colorado Springs last November, talk about the kinds of actions that you've been engaged in protecting abortion clinics.
It was pretty heavy, actually, when the Planned Parenthood was held at gunpoint. People were held hostage. People were murdered. And in the broad public discourse, shaped by the ruling class media, shaped by the ruling class politicians, that incident has become, in most people's understanding, either forgotten about entirely or become characterized as sort of just yet another incident of a mass shooting and gun violence. And what's been erased is the idea, not the idea, the reality, that this was anti-abortion terrorism. This was a Christian fanatic who went into a clinic and said, I'm a warrior for the babies. He was going to kill people because this was a clinic that enabled women to decide for themselves when and whether to have a child. So I think that the fight over abortion is really, it's never been about babies, it's been about control over women. And the religious fanaticism is driven by the desire to enslave women. And so myself and then others that I work with, we went and fought very hard for people to recognize this as an act of terror against women, not just random gun violence, a terror against women. And so we went and did vigils and then protests in 5 cities across the country. And it's shameful, frankly, that mainstream so-called pro-choice or abortion rights organizations, they did not do anything. They sent fundraising letters to their mailing list. The level of terrorism and stalking and violence against abortion clinics and doctors and providers has doubled in the last 5 years. it's escalated dramatically. And here you have a mass shooting because directed at a women's clinic because they do abortions, and silence. Almost nobody does anything about it. So this is where StopPatriarchy.org has really stepped out and called on people. Yes, we have to rely on ourselves, and we have to go into the streets, and we have to fight back.
The Walk for Life, that's what it's called. Who's behind that? Who are some of the fundamentalists that are behind organizing these marches?
A lot of it is the mainstream Catholic institutions. Catholicism opposes birth control, family planning of any kind, as well as abortion. And so a lot of the people who come out, they're Catholic school kids who are bused in, and it's mandatory for them to attend. A lot of churches come as institutions. There's tens of thousands of people who come out to these, and they span the spectrum from the most extreme, organized, more terrorist-type, fascist, shock troop type organizations to people who are quote unquote more mainstream anti-abortion organizations. And you'll have the people out there who shame black women in particular and call it genocide for black women to get abortions. And of course, have the same view of black women that the slave masters did, that their duty is to breed children. Black women should have the right to abortion, and they should have the right to have children, just like every other woman. But they put a special targeting on black women and a lot of shame and demonization of black women. So there's a whole spectrum of who comes out. And when we counter-protest, you know, our main purpose of being there is to expose this is a woman-hating and a women-enslaving agenda, and it has to be resisted. And we're calling on others to join us in standing up and fighting back. But there is a dimension where we actually are speaking directly to, especially the young people and especially the women who have been indoctrinated with this religious fundamentalism and have never had it challenged and have never heard anybody say a fetus is not a baby and have the science to back it up. And women are not incubators and abortion is not murder. And so we're bringing this message also to a lot of the young people, especially who are on that so-called walk for life. I always call it a walk for forced motherhood because it's not for life. And so it's not the main reason we go out, but it is part of why we go out, is to actually reach especially the young people who have been indoctrinated. And some of them, you know, are going to break out of that. And we have to go fight for them to do so because they're acting and they're being foot soldiers for a movement, which is actually, it's a very, very damaging, dangerous movement to the half of humanity that's female, including many of them. And so we need to fight for them as well.
Sansara, you're back east right now and engaged in nonviolent direct action in opposed to these so-called Walk for Life marches. What's in the future for Stop Patriarchy? What is your overall direction? And I know you're part of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which addresses imperialism and corporate power and change, and certainly the new information that 63 billionaires or 62 won't have more wealth than half of the entire world contributes to that. And those are mostly men. So patriarchy is not just women's rights and abortion rights, but a much broader agenda, correct?
Yeah. I think there's a number of levels of what you just asked, so I'll try to take a couple of them. And one is I am a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And what that means is that I've come to recognize that the problems of the war on women, which you're right, it goes beyond the war on abortion rights. It's the way that women are raped and stalked and abused at astronomical rates. It's the way that women are humiliated and hounded and ridiculed in the mainstream culture. It's the way that pimping is glorified. I mean, trafficking and beating and selling women and young girls is glorified as part of the culture. The violence in pornography, the degradation and humiliation, the way millions of women are trafficked around the world, all of this is part of the oppression of women, and it's woven into the system of imperialism. It's woven into the economy, it's woven into the culture, it's woven into the economic structure of the family as a building block of society, a patriarchal family. And so as a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, I recognize that this is woven into the system, and it's the same system that terrorizes and guns down black youth by their police. It's the same system that unleashes its armies around the world with its drones and assassinations and unjust occupations and torture. It's the same system that's destroying the environment through its blind pursuits of profit. So we need to to actually bring that system down. And when we're out there fighting the power today, we're building up the strength and we're changing people's thinking and getting ready for the time when we can bring this system down through an actual revolution, defeating and dismantling its armies and its militaries and building a new revolutionary state power. And so that's where my eyes are set. And on that, I would strongly recommend people look into the leadership that's being provided, the theoretical framework and the practical leadership for that revolution that Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has been providing over decades. And you can find that at revcom.us. It's a website, www.revcom.us. We have to fight back today. We absolutely have to fight back today. But if we don't engage the strategic questions of where does all this oppression stem from and what will it take to end it, we're going to be fighting the same battles generation after generation. We need to get to a world where never again does a woman know what it's like to be forced to have a child against her will, to be terrified if she misses her period, to be shamed if she has sex, to be afraid to walk down the street at night or to come home to her own home, which is where a lot of the abuse takes place. Where never again do black parents have to fear for the lives of their children at the hands of the police just for being out on the street and being kids and having fun. Where never again do kids in Pakistan or Yemen have to be afraid, literally, of sunny days, because those are the days with clear skies when the drones come. We need a world where that is no more, and so we need to be fighting back today. We need to go and confront the March for Life. We need to stand up for women's liberation now, but we need to also be engaging and doing the work and getting into the theory and the movement for revolution that Bob Avakian is leading so that we can end this. So that would be my two answers. We need to get into the leadership, and we need to get into the struggle. And with Stop Patriarchy, it is a movement that encompasses revolutionaries like myself, as well as people coming from a great diversity of other perspectives. We don't all agree on the problem and the solution, but we all agree that no one should sit back and rely on the institutions of power in this country to somehow self-correct what's happening to women. We have to rely on ourselves. We have to go into the streets. We have to stand up. And we have to change how millions are thinking, including about the question of abortion. But this is about women's liberation or women's enslavement, and there is no neutral, and you have to pick a side and you have to come out and stand up.
Sansara, thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Peter, thanks for making the time. It's always a joy to speak with you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 27 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. I'm Peter Phillips, and we'll see you next time. Up next, Tara Burning.
Ritualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks of all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip the brothers in.